Good morning, everybody. Oh, I'm happy to see us all. It's such a pleasure always to come back into this room and see us, right? Those of us who come regularly, those of us who come every once in a while. Okay, well, welcome back, everybody. And take a minute and just take in each other's faces. If you have the capacity to turn your video on for just a couple of minutes to be able to see each other and be seen, that's wonderful, because then we actually get a sense of ourselves, our faces. It's just so lovely. Thank you for doing that. Because the cool thing is nobody knows who's looking at whom when, right? So it really doesn't matter. You can just look at each other and hopefully not feel funny about it. So, welcome everybody. I am joining you from the ancestral land of the Wiat. I'm about 300 miles north of San Francisco in McKinleyville, California, in the Redwoods on the coast, where we have had some truly luscious rain the last couple of days. What a treat after so much wildfire, smoggy air, such a shift. And the other day I was sitting in here and it just gently rained the whole day. And I just felt like I was in that place of gratitude the entire day for that shift and that my lungs had an easier time. So if you've had some rain or if the weather has shifted to a more moderate place, take it in, really, really, really enjoy that. So, how our morning will go, our 2-hour retreat, we will start here shortly with an arriving meditation and then a short Dharma talk to follow up on what we talked about last week. We'll have a little longer meditation and then we'll dive into today's topic, and there will be plenty of time to talk with each other. Any questions? Okay, so invite yourself into a posture that feels good in your body. And I really mean to invite yourself in to be your own special guest, the one you've been waiting for. So happy to have this time with yourself. And even if there's some resistance or that doesn't feel accurate to what you're noticing right now, it still is an invitation to arrive and be here exactly as you are. Welcoming a guest exactly as they are into the comfort of your home, treating yourself that way. The home of the heart. The home of the mind, the home of the body, the home of your entire being. Welcome. Sensing the places the body is touching, whatever it's touching, furniture, floor, the earth, touching itself. Perhaps getting a sense of being grounded in this body at this time. And becoming aware of the breathing. Let us breathe and know you're breathing. You might notice where you feel your breath the most. the response of the body, the motion the body makes in response to the inhale and then the exhale. Becoming present with this breathing body. Arriving here. And whatever is happening in the mind, heart, in the body, the invitation for our entire time together is to allow whatever is here to be here. In thought, in sensation, in feeling, in emotion, energies. In making enough space for everything to be here. We'll begin with this poem from William Stafford called Yes. It could happen any time. Tornado, earthquake, Armageddon. It could happen. Or sunshine, love, salvation. It could, you know. That's why we wake and look out. No guarantees in this life, but some bonuses, like morning, like right now, like noon. Like evening. Welcome back. So last week, at the end of our time together, I asked if there were any topics or questions that anybody had that you'd like for me to address today. And I'm going to. I will do that in our longer Dharma talk after our longer meditation. So just know that I'm coming. I'm coming to that, and it will happen. But first, I want to just do a very short recap on what we talked about last week to see if there are any questions. We talked about this quality of practice called sadha, which is the Pali word for faith, also translated as trust or confidence. And my favorite translation of sadha is to place the heart upon, and in this case, a path of practice that has the possibility of awakening, that offers the possibility of awakening. And these different aspects of faith that we talked about, bright faith, that sense of maybe, you know, when you find something and you say, oh, this is it. We could think about it as infatuation, but it's that feeling of, that brightness that happens because you know you've landed in a place that feels really right. And then doubts can arise, and it can go to borrowed faith where we need each other. And then we sort of get our footing and we move into what is known as verified faith. And then over time, we have developed what is called abiding faith, which we just do trust this practice. And we can go through the cycles of doubt and coming back over and over again, but there's something that is steady that we know we can trust. So I'm wondering if anybody has any questions, if there was anything that you were left with that was a little bit of a question that you wanted to go back to. Okay, so if a question comes up, either write it down, send it to Carlita, we will get to it. So I don't know about you, but oftentimes for me, with a lot of these teachings, they can make so much sense, and I can feel that bright faith about it, those feelings of, oh yes, I get it, this sounds exactly right. But then I typically have this in the background voice that says, okay, that sounds great, but how am I supposed to do that? Does anybody else have that? That you wonder? Yeah, thanks, Christy. Yes, for sure. Gwen, yeah. Because it's not enough for some teaching or some practice to sound good, because it's just not enough. We need to know how. And in our practice, the Buddha gave us a lot of answers to how. So for me, what I think is necessary, well, there are many things that I think are necessary. And Carlita and I were just having a conversation right before class about how we can start talking about one aspect of practice and start tugging on it a little bit and see how it's connected to every aspect of practice. And there's not one answer here about how do I cultivate trust and confidence in a practice. There's so many things that we can draw on. But for right now, what I want to talk about is one of the paramis. And the paramis, as you might be familiar, are these 10 different expressions of the heart, components of the heart that we are asked to develop to form a fully responsive, wise, kind heart. And so the paramis include generosity and morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy and effort, that's one, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. So as I made that list, you might have thought, oh yeah, that one, oh yeah, that one, oh yeah, that one, that's how I'm going to do it. Or I got to do all of them, but how am I going to do all of them? So I want to talk specifically about determination today. What is that oomph that keeps us going? And you might think, oh, well, that comes under energy. Kind of does. But this is what I mean about sometimes it's really hard to talk about one thing without talking about another thing. So the question that I want to just come back to for this few minutes is, how am I supposed to cultivate this trust and confidence? And I think that an element of resolve is important. And the Pali word is adhitana, A-D-H-I-T-T-A-N-A. That means resolve or determination. If you've ever heard the instruction in meditation, come back, begin again, right? We've all heard begin again 1,000 times, because it's what we do 1,000 times. But what kind of energy do we come back with? Is it an energy that is curious, that is open, that is present? Or is it sleepy? Or fine, I'll come back again. You know, it could be like that. And we are going to experience all of those things, because these energies come and go in different ways and different flavors on a regular basis. But gentle persistence is a phrase that I relate to that I really appreciate, because I'm not trying to pound myself into any specific place. I want to show up gently, with kindness, but persistently, with a certain amount of determination. And what am I determined to do? You know, I think that we'll talk in a little while about intention, but I am determined to cultivate my intention, which is to show up in my life with more and more awareness and kindness, so I cause less and less harm and I can be of more and more benefit. It's actually that simple. And it's not simple, but it is really what it is. And I am determined to do that. In his book, Crossing the Floods, which is a gorgeous study and commentary on the Paramis, Ajahn Suchito, wonderful teacher, what he says in this book is, so one determines to be generous, to refrain from doing harm, to let go of what needs to be relinquished, to discern and investigate, and to bring energy, patience, and truthfulness to one's practice. That's the determination. So in that sentence, you could probably hear the other paramis, right? So one determines to be generous, to refrain from doing harm, right? The morality, the ethics, to let go of what needs to be relinquished, the renunciation, the commitment towards simplicity, to discern and investigate, that's where the wisdom arises from. To bring energy, right? Now, you have to have a little turbo behind this, right? You have to have a little bit of oomph happening to support this determination, and patience. So does that go together? How do determination and energy work with patience? And Ajahn Suchito says the most beautiful thing about patience. He says, patience is when we can relax the edges of time to make some space for something else to arise. Isn't that gorgeous? Patience is when we can relax the edges of time to make the space for something else to arise. And our determination and our energy supports our ability to make space, to relax those edges. And truthfulness to one's practice, right? And that's a very long conversation. What is truthfulness? What is true? What is truth? How many things can be true at once? But I think we're talking about a certain amount of honesty with ourselves. So this determination can come from different teaching stories. And you know the story of Mara. My guess is many of you know the story of Mara. Mara was the mythological character in the story of the Buddha's awakening, the one who always tried to get the Buddha to not stay on this path of awakening, the trickster, the coyote. Sometimes when we think about it through Western psychology, it's the inner critic, the one who sows doubt inside of us. And so the story goes that on the night of the Buddha's awakening, he had been sitting under the Bo tree for a week. And during that week, Mara kept showing up to tempt him to get up and leave with various kinds of temptations. And every single time one of these temptations would come to the Buddha would, with his right hand on the earth, this is a story, of course, who knows if it's true, he would say to Mara, "Mara, I see you, and I'm not afraid." And it said that the armies of Mara would dissipate right there. Every single time he said, "Mara, I see you." That's the truthfulness. And it's also infused with this determination. Can I see clearly enough to stay right here? I see what's happening. What are the Maras of my mind? What are the Maras of my heart? But my intention is strong enough to keep me here. But we don't want it to be too tight or too loose. And this is where the energy comes in. The Buddha also gave us this analogy, or the metaphor rather, of is our energy and is our determination like a stringed instrument? If we're wound too tight, we'll snap. It won't work. And we can't get a tone. If we're wound too loosely, we can't get a tone. We can't get our momentum. We can't get it going. So learning, where is that balance of this stringed instrument of ourselves being turned to just the right place so we get a tone that supports us? That's part of the determination to cultivate the confidence in practice. Not too tight, not too loose. To be willing to stick with it. And it's hard, right? It can be hard to stick with it, but we have these practices of Sangha, you know, coming here on Wednesday mornings is a practice. Wherever your Sanghas are, and it's not always the same every week because schedules change. So we know that. But we may have places we can go on Sundays or Wednesdays or Thursdays or Fridays. That's what we do. But doubts can arise. And so we need reminders. Sangha is a reminder, or some other practice is a reminder. And I do dearly love the story of one student who was struggling mightily, and he was working with his teacher for a very long time. And one day, he came to his teacher and said, I think I finally figured out how to remember, to come back, to begin again. And the story goes that he had tattooed on his palms. One palm said, I love you. The other palm, keep going. So he could look at his palms and be reminded of his own care for himself. I love you. Keep going. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, just do two things. Begin and keep going. How we keep going is up to us. That is our own way of keeping going. Some people study scripture, really deep, take a deep dive into the suttas themselves. And if that's something that feels alive for you, do it. Or if you're curious, do it. See how that feels. Some people keep going by having a very strong daily formal meditation practice. Some people keep going by making sure they're practicing in community. And some people do all of those things. But you can make a practice of anything that keeps you, brings you back to your wholesome intentions towards kindness, towards non-harming, towards awareness. And make it yours. And make it yours. And so over and over again, we can do what's called resolve to begin again. Make practice your whole life. Because it actually is. How we show up is a practice. And then there are some compass questions that can be helpful to guide us and bring us back. And it might be you do some writing on one of these things, or you drop in one of these questions as an inquiry into your meditation, or maybe you just start it with your day as a way to form an intention for the day. And one of my favorite, these are some of my favorite questions that I'm going to give you. I think of them as compass questions. And this comes from Suzuki Roshi, when one of his students said to him, what is the most important thing? Of all of this practice, what is the most important thing? And his response is to find out what is the most important thing. That is, I love you, keep going, isn't it? It really is, because what is the most important thing right now might not be the same as tomorrow. Or there might be the overarching big most important things. But then there might be what is needed of me in the next shorter period of time, today, this morning. Or maybe you're meeting with a friend and you might think to yourself, what is the important thing about this time with my friend? Right? So it's very, very immediate. And one of the questions that I've read in varying ways from different scholars is a question that came from the Buddha. is what I'm involved with for my welfare and the welfare of others? And if not, why not? If what I am involved with is what I am involved with for my welfare and for the welfare of others, and if not, why do it? So that's the injunction that says, really paying attention to what are our choices and how do they contribute, and understanding that we are part of something much bigger than ourselves. And it doesn't mean that we don't do things that are specifically for our own well-being. We do, and that's important, because by caring for ourselves deeply, we really are caring for others because we can show up better. And you know, we're not always going to get it right, are we? You know, there are going to be times where we miss the mark. And okay, so we miss the mark. And another one of my favorite teachings from Zen practice that supports my determination and supports my energy and supports my ability to cultivate confidence and trust is this Zen teaching that says, when you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. When you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. That's just so great, because who among us hasn't fallen? And when we can get rid of that, I'm just going to say it like this, itty bitty shitty committee that lives in the mind that says, how could you have done that? Didn't you know better? No, we say, oh, missed the mark. And can we let our times of falling down on the ground, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, make good use of the mud, right? Make good use of the mud. What are we learning here? Because I have found, this is actually something that has been such a gift to me through this practice, is the ability to apologize. Is training in compassionate communication to not be afraid to say, I blew it. I am so sorry. And I told you all last month this really funny story about painting my house the wrong color and having to say to my husband, oh my God, I totally blew it, and how that took all of the heat out of the problem. I really mean it in practical terms like that. You know, the training in compassionate communication and not beating ourselves up when we make a mistake, because how human are we? But to be able to say, I blew it. Okay, let me tell you the end of actually this painting story. It's actually a pretty good color now. It's still green, but it's pretty good. But one of the things that happened that I don't think I told you about as an example of, or part of this whole story, is that I was doing a lot of traveling in July, ended August and September. And part of that traveling was that in between teaching and retreats, I had 3 weeks before teaching the river rafting retreat. And I was in Colorado and in Utah. And my husband was going to meet me after a retreat that I sat as a student, and we were going to have actually a really long vacation that we haven't had together for a while. So he was going to pick me up from the retreat in Colorado, and we were going to go do a bunch of things and then drop me off in Utah for the start of the river retreat. Well, I knew that this house painting project was happening, and we were talking to different painters, and one day the painter came over, a man who we were really hoping we would be able to have do the house. And he came over, and he and my husband worked it all out. And Bill came in the house, and he said, I worked it all out, and he's going to start on August 14th. And I said, that's the day you're picking me up from the retreat that our vacation starts. And he said, well, that's when I could get him. And I said, well, what about our vacation? He said, that's when I could get him. I said, well, couldn't you have said, can we start on September 14th? And so you can imagine where this conversation went, right? So, And I said, well, what's wrong with September 14th? He said, because that starts the rainy season. We have to get him when we can get him. I said, it doesn't rain until November. So, okay. So then, you know, that's what happened. We readjusted. I had to readjust my hopes and expectations. And he totally got it about, I just totally blew up our vacation and I promise I'll make it up to you. So, and that's all happening, but it was not how I wanted it, right? And then I chose the wrong color and it got even more complicated. And then we fixed the color and it's all fine. I came home in between these two trips. So I did some extra travel, which also turned out to be fine. And then the project got completely finished by the middle of September. And literally, you know, 10 days later, we had 2 days of solid rain. And this is my point, is so that I said to my husband last night, I just want to tell you that you were really right about when to get this project done, because if we had all this painting going on and now all the rain started, this really would have been a problem. And, you know, it felt really good to say, I want to tell you that you were right and I was wrong about this. And there was no value judgment. And that is my point in all of this. I didn't have any negative talk inside of me about this whole thing. It was just meeting the situation as it was. And so that's what I mean about this practice. I have learned much better how to meet conflict, how to be with it in a way that doesn't make a difficult thing more difficult. And I for sure don't always get it right, but I'll tell you what, when I do get it right, and the consequences of getting it right, it's so reassuring. And so it cultivates the faith, it cultivates the confidence and the trust. That's my whole point in telling you that whole thing, because I want these practices to matter. That I want them to matter to me, and they do. And this is really how they show up. But we have to show up. That's the other key. We have to be present. So Joanna Macy says, the biggest gift you can give is to be absolutely present, even when you're worrying about whether you're hopeful or hopeless, or pessimistic or optimistic. The main thing is that you're showing up, that you're here, and that you're finding ever more capacity to love this world, because it will not be healed without it. So you just show up. You just show up. So we'll move into our meditation now. And I came across this piece from Stephen Batchelor in his book, After Buddhism, talking about meditation. He says, meditation is the ongoing cultivation of a sensibility, a way of attending to every aspect of experience within a framework of ethical values and goals. Isn't that beautiful? Let me read that to you again. Meditation is the ongoing cultivation of a sensibility, a way of attending to every aspect of experience within a framework of ethical values and goals. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend, right? So please find a posture that works well in your body. We'll be here for 15, 20 minutes. And always, all of the instructions I offer are invitations. Take what works for you. Leave everything else alone. Coming into this body, breathing, aware. And I'll offer you some intention phrases that I use in my own practice regularly. Sensing into the body, exactly in the places where it's touching the furniture or the floor, all of those touch points. May I be grounded in my body. You can say that to yourself if you like. May I be grounded in my body. And then coming up into the space of the heart, breathing in and out of the heart space. May my heart be open, soft, and stable. May my heart be open, soft, and stable. Sensing into the space of the mind. May my mind become clear and balanced. May my mind become clear and balanced. In this moment, may I breathe with ease. May I breathe with ease. Grounded in the body. Heart open, soft and stable. The mind becoming clear and balanced. Breathing with ease. So finding that place that feels most natural for you to rest your awareness, to settle the attention. Be it the body, the heart, any other practice that works for you, the breath. Let yourself settle there and stay there with a quality of energy and determination, steadiness, persistence, gentle persistence. Come back and begin again anytime the mind has wandered somewhere else. And we'll sit quietly. as you sit and breathe, softening, perhaps dropping the shoulders a little bit, loosening the jaw, softening the whole face, releasing the muscles of the chest and the belly, yet staying attentive, yet relaxed. If you're feeling at all sleepy, inattentive in any way, get a little closer if you can to the experience of breathing, being very attentive to the beginning, middle, and end of the inhale, And that little space before the exhale begins, notice that. And being attentive and present for the beginning, middle, and end of the exhale. And noticing the space before the next breath begins. It's a very good practice for cultivating concentration and steadiness and clarity. It's also very good for awakening the mind when it's sleepy. And then drawing the awareness into the heart space. And if you like, even placing a hand on the chest, imagining sending the warmth of your own body through the skin, through the muscles, through the bones, into literally the heart, but also what this heart space, this heart center, the energies of it, what it is, how you sense it, what it represents for you. And imagine breathing in and out of this space, inviting this opening, this softness, spacious stability of heart. Dropping in a few metta phrases. May I feel safe and protected. May I feel peaceful and happy. May I feel healthy and strong. May I be filled with loving kindness. This is called What We're Doing Here from Rosemary Wattola Traumer. This is why we are here, not merely to survive, but to fall in love with the white-breasted hawk and the rainbow fish, with the lonely sidewalk and the shadows of ourselves, fall in love with the hands of the woman wearing yellow, and the girl who loves chocolate, and the boy who loves cars, and the man who makes us want to be a better version of ourselves. We are here to fall into unmanageable love, to love beyond reason, beyond fact, beyond certainty. We are here to lose all our ideas about love and know it as the next choice we make, the next word we say, the next invitation we offer ourselves. We are here to love the world and each other, the way whales love water, the way blue loves a peacock, the way night-blooming jasmine loves night. Okay, let's take 5 minutes, come back, and we'll keep going. So see you at 10 after. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, let's dive in. So the two topics and questions that came in are completely related. And so here's what they are. Taking bodily sensations and reactions off the cushion out into everyday life in a skillful way. That's really important. How do we take the bodily sensations, what we feel, and their ripples, their earthquakes, their shocks, or their rumbles, their riffles? How do we take that, what we're learning on the cushion, when we stay with the body and we can feel something happening? What do we do with that? And how do we respond to that out in our walking around life? Now connect that with this next question, which is, I believe this is completely related. When our loving witnessing is met with ignorance, delusion, and ill will, what do we do? So let me repeat that. When our loving witnessing is met with ignorance, delusion, and ill will, how do we respond to that? So both of these questions are talking about the first two foundations of mindfulness. The first foundation of mindfulness, aware of the body, aware of the breath, mindfulness of the body and breath. This second foundation, now loving witnessing, we might dig into that a little bit, but showing up wholeheartedly. With that, does that actually define loving witnessing? Okay, thank you, Nancy. All right, so when we show up wholeheartedly, but we don't feel met, or maybe the way we show up does have some, the response to it might have some ill will, but just not, it's like this. Right, like when we don't connect and that there's this mismatch or we just don't get each other. So here's some ways to put those things together. One of Jack Kornfield's teachers, Munindraji, is famous for having said, "Sit and know you're sitting and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed." Sit and know you're sitting and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. So for me, the way I understand that instruction and that teaching is that when I am fully present and I know what I'm doing and I'm connected to my heart and to my commitment to not causing harm, and I know my intention, then I will start to understand how do greed and ill will and ignorance function in me? Can I see it in others? Can I see the interplay of it? But I also get to know what my body is telling me. So we can take that literally, sit and know you're sitting. So if I know what I'm doing, so this is coming back to this piece of defining meditation from Stephen Batchelor. Meditation is the ongoing cultivation of a sensibility, developing an awareness, right? A way of attending to every aspect of our experience within this framework of ethical values and goals, and I would say intentions. When I sit and know I'm sitting, that means I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. I know where I am. So that's metaphorical, okay? Sit and know you're sitting. Use that as a metaphor. But when it comes to the body, Donald will often teach about if you can keep most of your awareness in the body, there's a way in which we'll stay grounded and clear and stable. And then if the majority, maybe the majority isn't in the body, but there's a good portion of my awareness that can sense my feet on the floor, my bottom touching the chair, maybe even my hands on the desk. And when I can maintain some body awareness of sensation, I'm less likely to be spinning up here. I'm less in my head. I can still be in my mind. I can be in my heart, but I have more grounded. And so that piece of taking bodily sensations and reactions off the cushion out into everyday life, what is the body telling us? So sometimes we can't feel the body. And we started to touch on that last week, that it's just an idea. Oh, that the body might feel something. And that's fine, because it's essential that we start exactly where we are. We actually can't start where we're not. So that phrase, start where you are, is of course, because where else could we start from? So if body sensation, like if you hear the instruction, notice the feet touching the floor, and you have that thought, I can't, I don't feel that. Just notice what you do feel. You just notice what you do feel. It might be that what you need to do is touch your hands together and make it so accessible, because touching the hands together is pretty accessible. Just try it, you know, even if you just notice it, even think about it and feel the friction and just feel what does touch actually feel like? Is there pressure? Is there a sense of temperature? However you would describe it. And the Buddha said, within this fathom-long body and mind is found all of the teachings, which is the same as sit and know you're sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. So what we're getting to with both of these questions is, how do I stay in my body and get to know the wisdom of my body? And the wisdom of the body is essential. The body lives in the present moment, but it also has a history. So, you know, from the perspective of trauma-informed mindfulness, resiliency-focused work, we are tending to the body in an invitational way. And this is very important. We don't force anything. So if there's an instruction that says, let's say something like this. This would be an unskillful question, okay? Here's an unskillful question. What do you feel in your belly? Okay, that's a totally unskillful question. And the reason is not everybody can. But the skillful question is, do you notice anything in the area of the belly? Do you see the difference? What do you feel in the belly, or do you notice anything in the area of the belly? The reason this is so important is that it gives the person who is being asked the question the agency. You're in the driver's seat, not the person asking the question. So the answer might be a whole spectrum of answers. It could be, I just feel this little thing over here on my side. Does that count as my belly? Well, yeah, there's no wrong answers here. What you feel is what you feel. And this is really important from the perspective of our practice. What you notice is what you notice. The way you breathe is the way you breathe. And I don't think we can get this wrong. So back to that itty bitty shitty committee that says that we're doing things wrong, this inner critic. You know, that's what we're learning to quiet, that the way I sense into my experience is how I do, is how I sense into my experience. Now, you may be given instructions and suggestions and ideas for different ways to access an awareness of what is happening. Some will work, some will not work. And so when you hear the instruction, take what resonates and leave the rest behind. Doesn't mean throw the baby out with the bathwater. It means for today, this is what I'm noticing in my body. And we trust that. So you know when the Buddha said, don't ask me, find out from your own experience. So what the body, taking bodily sensations and reactions off the cushion, that requires some skill. So perhaps there's, in the context of this question, perhaps there is really uncomfortable, there might be very uncomfortable sensations happening in the body in the context of a formal meditation. So the place I start with that is, well, is this the kind of pain that I need to adjust my posture? There might not be an emotional component to it, so let's just take this apart a little bit. It might be that I'm sitting in a way that isn't good for my body, and that those physical sensations I can adjust. But I don't think that's what the question was about. So I just want to name that. Okay, so then there might be something coming up, sensations in the body that are related to emotional energies, that are related to an experience, and maybe something really difficult comes up and you think, I have to get up and go call that person right now and give them a piece of my mind because I can feel that anger inside me. And I'm totally making this up, by the way. And the inclination to dispel difficult energy is natural, right? So if there are energies arising, let's just take anger for the sake of the conversation, and we want to get rid of it because it's hard inside the body, we might think that the way to get rid of it is to call somebody up and yell at them. So that's unskillful, right? But it does dispel the energy. It does get that out. So the question is, what do we do with that in a skillful way? And it's a huge question about how can I be with what is happening inside of me, but also meet it with some compassion. So that's the place that it is starts with what we talked about, the sweetheart voice, right? Say, oh, this is painful. This is painful. Anger's here. I feel anger. Now that's different than saying I am angry. And this is something in our practice that is very functional, to shift the language between I am and I feel, right? Because we don't have to identify as I am angry to, and more skillful is I feel anger in the face of X, Y, and Z. Right there, there's a bigger awareness around being able to name the sensations and their consequences, what is happening. And in the difference between I am and I feel, we have more opportunity to to respond in a skillful way. The skillful way might be to do nothing, to go for a walk, to shake it off, to understand, oh, okay, this is what's here. Maybe there's some writing that needs to be done. And also it could be, I do need to call the person that I'm having this thing with and see if we can talk about it in a way that can be skillful. But so much of this is about pausing. It is about pausing and really thinking to oneself, what is the next best response to this? To understand the literal sensations of discomfort, the natural inclination to want to dispel the energy of the discomfort, and you can do that without harming yourself or anybody else. And literally, you know how animals shake? We can do that. We literally can shake it off. And doing that helps to reset the nervous system, because difficult bodily sensations that arise are difficult. They just are. Sometimes we can tolerate them, sometimes we don't. But it's so easy to want to have the inclination to get rid of it, and being careful that in the getting rid of it, it isn't causing more harm. Are you with me on this? Okay. How we take things out into the world in a skillful way is such a big study. It is our this is what we're talking about. This is our practice. And if we start looking at all of the practices of the heart, the practices of the Eightfold Path, the commitment to cultivating awareness, care and compassion, and then really through trial and error, taking the next step once you've given it thought. One time, somebody said to me not long ago, asked me what I'd really learned through this practice over all this time. And I said earlier about compassionate conversation. But the other thing that I am continuing to learn is impulse control. The difference between reactivity and responsiveness. When I feel discomfort and I want to dispel that energy, having the ability to wait. Can I just let this settle? Do I have to react, right? This is about transforming reactivity into responsiveness. Can we meet ourselves with this honesty of, oh, this is what's here? You know, and then there's that famous quote from Anais Nin that says, we don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are. We can't help but to see it as we are because of our conditioning. Because who else am I except from how I am? But this is a practice that helps peel back the layers to widen our capacity to say to somebody else, I'd really like to know where you're coming from on that. Let's have a conversation about it. Hard to do. I'm not saying any of this is easy, and that's why this is a lifelong practice. But we start to trust our gut. And then we come into this very deep practice of intention. So then what the body is telling us is important information. And we listen in. And that also is a practice. It might be that you play with that. There can be questions that you ask yourself, that maybe you are fiddling with some sort of decision. Maybe this isn't the biggest decision in the world. Okay, let's just like, what color are you going to paint the house? Okay, I mean, it really is something that is not life shattering in any way, something that's not that big. But when you ask yourself a certain question and you pause, and you listen into the body, what are you getting back? I think most of us have the experience of gut intuition. What does my gut say? And how often do we override that through the rational mind? A lot. And when do we have the courage to say, no, I'm going to listen to my gut on this? By the way, anecdotally, I listened to a really great podcast yesterday on mind and life. And Wendy Hassenkamp is the woman who does the interview, and who moderates the podcast. And Carlita, if you could try to find this under podcasts, Mind and Life. And she was interviewing a physician who's a gastroenterologist at UCLA, and he was talking about the gut brain, the mind brain, and the microbiome and the ancient history of the microbiome and how it relates to our contemplative practice. It was a very, very good interview. But it goes to that place of, we have so much wisdom and the body knows. And if we have the courage not to override what our body is telling us, we come into a very powerful place of wisdom and we start living out of what is really true for us. And I know that's not easy. Some things are easier than others. Are you with me on this? This gut thing about appropriate response in the body. Oh, good. Carlita found the podcast. Okay, so now, when our loving witnessing is met with ignorance, delusion, and ill will, it all comes down to intention. We are not responsible for... This is really hard. There's so many parts of this. I really want you to enjoy what I offer here. I really do. I want to be of benefit. I want to be of service. But you might not like it. It might not sit. It might be boring. It might not be what you wanted. That is not my problem. But I'll tell you what, it doesn't mean it's easy. Okay, so my intention is to be of service, to be of benefit, to study, to practice. So when I show up here, that what I offer, actually you find it of benefit. But whether you do or not, I have zero control, zero influence over how it's received. So when you show up and you think you're showing up with love as a loving witness, but it's not met the way you wanted it to meet, that's painful. That's painful because it can feel like a rejection of us. But this is when we start to really practice with the three marks of experience, the truth of change, the truth of impermanence, the truth of it's not about me. It's not personal. It is not perfect. It is not permanent. Now, that doesn't mean we don't miss the mark and we might blow it and need to come back, as we've talked about, and say, I did it wrong. I'm so sorry. But when somebody doesn't get us or feel our intention, they don't. That said, there's a very tricky part of this practice, which sometimes our intentions have an unplanned, harmful impact. This is tricky, 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 the difference between intention and impact. And it is a practice, because how many of us have said, I didn't mean to, right? Me too. I didn't mean to. Well, of course we didn't mean to, but sometimes shit happens and we learn from it. We really need to learn from it. So we start seeing these three marks of experience. We see how these three poisons of greed and ill will and delusion are functioning in everybody and in everything. And from the perspective of the Bodhisattva that we've talked a lot about, as practitioners, as those who are interested in ending suffering in all of its permutations, we see the suffering and it's our job to meet it. And we don't always meet it in the best way. And so we learn from it. We really learn from it. Remember this really cool little poem from Hafiz? You carry all the ingredients to turn your life into a nightmare. Don't mix them. You carry all the ingredients to turn your existence into joy. Mix them, mix them. So this is a practice of we're finding out what are those parts of me that don't support my well-being or your well-being? And how do we help them stay in abeyance or uproot them? And how do we recognize all the parts of us that do good? And how do we support and cultivate them? So it comes down to intention. It comes down to the ability to pause. So in this ability to pause, hang on one sec. I'll give you a few acronyms. And this is just like 911 for when you're totally reactive. So this goes to both questions. Stop. Just stop. And the STOP acronym, S is for stop. T, tune in and take a breath. O, open and observe. What is happening here? And P, pause or proceed or park it. But stop, tune in and take a breath, open and observe, pause, and then proceed. And you can do this in a couple of breaths, like physically stop, take a breath, close your eyes maybe, tune in. Oh, what's happening here? Take a breath, open to what's happening here, pause, and when you're ready, proceed. That is a really great way to do an end run on reactivity. But you got to remember to do it, right? You got to remember to do it. And when you stop, then you wait. And here's another acronym for wait. What am I thinking? What am I thinking? Because we're so fast, we don't actually stop and say, wait a minute, what am I thinking? Because there's all this swirl going around. And then Sylvia says another way to talk about wait is, why am I talking? Why am I talking? So stop, wait, and wait, or wait, stop, wait. But that's what we're doing for this pause. And then she gives us two others. There's T-I-O, think it over, right? And one from one of her kids who said, Mom, gag it, get a grip. When we're really off, get a grip. Now, we're not meaning to talk unkindly to ourselves. So, you know, we can say get a grip with the sweetheart voice. We can say get a grip with a funny voice, but be kind. But these are acronyms that can really help do an end run on that reactivity that address both those questions. What do I do in my body right now? How do I proceed? We have to start with pausing. And one of my very favorite definitions of mindfulness is choice. It comes down to choice. Because when I'm aware and when I'm present with the intention to be kind, I have a choice of how to behave. Sylvia once said when we were talking about practice, she said, you know, any antipathy in the mind is itself the cause of suffering. The intention to meet this moment fully and to meet it as a friend is where we start, because that's the only place the mind can rest. The point is to habituate the mind to kindness. So noticing the flavors and the permutations of antipathy and what does that lead to? And then we come to the intention to show up, to be present, to be kind, to know the difference between all of those things, how to know what is kindness and what does it feel like. But we start where we are. And when we give ourselves the permission to pause and to start from there, there is some resting of the mind. That's the reset, right? Like resetting that GPS. Okay, I'm going to start from here. I'm going to go there. So intention, wise intention, this piece of the Eightfold Path, it's the second step. It's the second factor of the Eightfold Path. You can take that question, what when I do it will be for the welfare and happiness of both myself and others? There's a great story that Tara Brach tells of that happened 20, 25 years ago, where she was on a 6-person panel to talk about the Dharma and to talk about what is the Dharma. And it was a conference, a big Buddhist conference, and she was second in line to give her 10 minutes. Everybody had 10 minutes to talk about the Dharma. And the first person in front of her was Roshi Richard Baker from San Francisco Zen Center. And she was glad she was second because she only had 10 minutes to be nervous. And then it was her turn. So Roshi Baker came up to the podium and he had his formal Zen robes on and he placed his hands together and he said, "The key to freedom is intention and attention. The key to freedom is intention and attention." And he bowed and he walked off the stage. That was his 10 minutes. And the way Tara tells the story is she thought, all I wanted to do was go up there and say, like he said, because what else is there to say, right? The key to freedom is intention and attention. But I think it's also attitude. So let's talk about wise intention for a few minutes. And I realize I have not opened this up for a big group discussion because I just had so much to say, but I'm going to do it soon. Can you imagine the recycling logo? And let's put intention up there, then attention and attitude. And they go around and around and around. Why am I here? What am I? Where am I placing my attention? And what is the orientation of my heart? What is my attitude right now? The importance of intention and the energy inside of us, it's that motivational and volitional force, the determination. And of course, there's short, medium, and long range goals, intentions rather, momentary, episodic, like what's happening right in this moment, what is my intention? Episodic, I'm going for lunch with a friend. What is my intention here? And long range, we know what long range is, the overarching intention to become more kind, to become more clear, to cause less harm. But they all require attention, where the mind goes, energy flows, right? Am I gonna, you know, what are we doing? Where is our energy? What are we spending time doing? Does it support our intention? Or as the Buddha said, that which one frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So hang out with goodness, you know, and it develops more goodness. Hang out with sourness, develops more sourness. It's pretty logical. So what's important, meaningful, and creative, and living a life that's in line with your values? We need an attitude. We need to bring that heartfulness to it. That's what I mean about attitude. And actually, one of the clearest ways to think about this is this piece from Mahagosananda, who said, the thought becomes the word becomes the deed develops into habit, and the habit hardens into character. And so here's the clincher about intention, attention, and attitude. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of respect for all beings. As the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. So that includes both those questions. What do I do about the body sensations and the reactions? What do I do about when I'm not seen for what I was trying to do, the love that I was bringing, when it's met with antipathy. So many things to say about this. So quickly, there are three components in wise intention. And one is renunciation, the letting go and letting things just be. I don't have to be so beholden to my views. Can I just open up? As opposed to greed, graspy, clingy, sticky desire, this letting be. Loving kindness is another component of wise intention. Am I coming from a place of non-ill will, of really wishing well for everybody involved? And compassion, a dedication to non-harming. So you can see just from that how tricky this is. Wise intention, can we open up? Can we let go of what is unnecessary? Can we really intend? Can we come from a place of really wishing well for everyone? May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. That is the intention in wise intention. And can we show up and meet pain with a little love? Can my vulnerability meet your vulnerability? That is compassion, because there's an instinctive kindness that arises out of that. And that's wise intention. Okay, so I've said so much today, and I'd love to hear what you're thinking. We have 15 minutes. Let's talk with each other. Anybody who has a question, a comment on anything I said from the start of our time until now, I'd love to hear from you. Christy, please.
I think the challenging thing is I've been going through some very challenging times, and like I'm realizing that my reactivity is centered in like, I guess that Thich Nhat Hanh would say, like an unwholesome seed that was planted so long ago.
That I
keep reacting. It's like taking all of my energy to like keep myself balanced, but there are other people in my life. So the reacting to that unwholesome seed that has nothing to do with the people in my life. And then like having that mentality to sit down and work through it. And even yesterday, I was like sitting on my cushion and I had so much to say to this person. And I realized that point of impatience.
Mm-hmm,
everybody. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that tipped me off that maybe what I'm seeing is not necessarily like the correct perception of what's happening. And fortunately, you know, I started writing things down. I couldn't stay there. So I started writing things down of what I wanted to say. And then it became the practice of, well, if I exit myself and my thoughts about myself and my selfishness out of this, then what does the question become?
Isn't that a really, really getting down to brass tacks with yourself, right?
And I failed many, many times in the past 6 months. And that, like what you were saying from the apologies and, you know, from Thich Nhat Hanh and Sister Chan Kong, the beginning anew, mm-hmm. and just immediately saying, okay, well, my perception was wrong here. I apologize for the things that I said, but I mean, it causes suffering still.
It doesn't make it easier, right? It doesn't make it easier. It, in some ways it does, but it also is true that in recognizing our misperceptions, there can be pain.
Yeah.
Right? There can be pain. And that's where the practice of humility comes in, that just says, I'm so sorry I blew it. And also being kind enough to yourself to know that the unwholesome seeds, so the seeds that are inside of us that get dropped there, maybe intergenerationally, maybe, you know, like who knows exactly where and how and when, but oftentimes they sprout in the face of fear. And So to work with fear, which might be related to loss, to impermanence, the truth of dukkha, you know? Yeah, exactly. The more you work this practice of understanding those seeds, there's a way in which you can be loving to those seeds to say, okay, thank you, but that's actually not what I need right now. You can lie dormant, but thanks for showing your face and reminding me of that part. And I'm not actually making light of it. I'm actually very serious that we have those latent parts of ourselves that have been conditioned from who knows. Maybe we know, maybe we don't, but maybe it doesn't matter if we know where it's come from. The important question is, where is the suffering leading? Right, like Thich Nhat Hanh says, make good use of the mud. It's the same thing about where is this leading. But the ability to go back and say, okay, I got it wrong. I need a restart on this. And it can be exhausting, Christy.
It is. It's all exhausting. Yeah. And I'm not trying to make light of it either, but yes, it is exhausting. And I'm very grateful for the practice to, keep that as much equanimity as humanly possible and challenging.
So there's a really good word for as much equanimity as is humanly possible. It's, let me just get it for you so I say it exactly correctly. It's a pretty cool word in Pali. Tatramajatata.
Tatramajatata?
Uh-huh. Tatra, T-A-T-R-A. This is all one word. M-A-J-J-H. A-T-T-A-T-A. And it means here in the middleness. It sort of sounds like exactly what it means. Tatra Maja Tata. Here in the middleness with balance. It's about equanimity and perspective. Like there's a storm going on here and I'm in the middle of it and I got to figure out the best way to move. Is that helpful?
Yes, it is.
Good. I'm glad.
No, but yes.
What, but yes?
I said no, but yes. I feel
I know. Well, I'm just saying, yeah, I hear you. I totally hear you. And you know, in time. I mean, it's just like, in time. Yeah. It's like this is the mud. You're in the mud.
It's a lot. It's up to my neck.
You got to remember to breathe and eat. You're welcome. Nancy.
First of all, kudos to Christy. I think she's doing fabulous work in looking at her own experience and learning from it. Wow, I'm just totally impressed by what she's going through. Yeah, how she's dealing with what she's going through. Yeah,
that's right.
Second is this is something that was just not one of your major points, but it was like a throwaway when you were talking about Mara. You said your inner critic is Mara. Mm-hmm. And I haven't completely explored that thought yet, but that is just fascinating to me because my initial impression is you don't have to believe it because it's Mara.
So yes, right. Totally right. Because you don't have to believe everything you think. And that's a bumper sticker. But that inner critic is Mara, and there are uses of the inner critic. We know that. I mean, there are some times in which the inner critic related to what Christy said might be about something that thinks it needs to keep us safe that we don't need it to keep us safe. And that's not exactly what you said, Christy, but it's around like these unwholesome seeds that... Yes, Nancy, and that actually wasn't a throwaway. I just have like so many things to say today that it is a way of relating to Mara as the inner critic.
Right. Actually, I would flip that. I would say it's a way of relating to the inner critic
as Mara. That's
as
right,
Mara, because it takes away the credibility.
So right. So yeah. Right. Oh, I love that you're saying this. Yeah. Isn't this great what we can figure out together? I mean, seriously, you know, there's a lot of wisdom here and this is not just what's going to come from me. So I'm so glad you're saying that was a throwaway, but it wasn't a throwaway because that really mattered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi.
You're welcome. Who else? What's on your heart? What's on your mind? What are you thinking about? Do you feel like I just did a like total mind dump? Like, was it way too much? And saying, yeah, that was a lot. Yes, please.
I needed every bit of it.
Oh, good.
It was a lot and it all fits together. So thank you ever so much.
You're so very rich. You're so welcome. So for those who submitted the questions, do you feel that I met and answered the questions that you had around the body and around, okay, good. I'm very glad. Yeah, Nancy.
It is different when truly the other side has no goodwill. There isn't a way to solve it. Like to, mm-hmm. even if you have like, you're not reactive, you're thinking, you're like, have chosen something like to be solution based. That is not what's happening on the other side. It is a dead end. And, okay. That's, you know, fortunately kind of rare.
Yeah. But you know, I think it's an important point because sometimes we're very solution oriented. Right. Yeah. Culturally, we're very solution oriented. So what is it like to not have to do that? To actually.
Well, the solution is also part of like, if there's no good intention, if there isn't a way to
meet. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then let's take one of the components of wise intention, which is renunciation, which is letting go.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. There. Okay. So there isn't a meeting here. There's not a commonality. There's not something that we can agree to here. Then we need to let go of the need to agree.
Yeah. And
that is huge right in and of itself. You know, there's a.
It is. It's shocking.
It is. So here is a little meditation for that.
Yeah.
You have your path. I have my path. And I care about you.
Yeah.
And that can shift what's happening when there isn't a meeting that, and you know, we can apply that to all the divisiveness in our culture right now. The political differences, what's happening within families with different views. It doesn't mean we don't love our family members. And the ability to say, you know, this is my path and I respect your path. I respect that you have your path and I care about you.
Yes. And I want to say something.
Yes.
Even if that's not coming from the other side, it's not a mutual.
Oh, it doesn't have to be. It's not dependent on that.
The other side could be actually trying to be malicious and harmful.
That's right.
But yeah. That's what I'm saying.
This is a practice that one can do. Yes, I hear you 100%.
Yeah.
This practice is a compassionate equanimity practice that one can bring into a meditation. Literally, there might be a person with whom there is this friction, with whom there is this, like you're actually getting ill will, like you actually can't meet. But you can visualize right. them in your meditation and give them the gift of, I have my path, you have your path, and I care about you. Because what that does is it employs the heart of caring and it helps to do what the Dalai Lama calls of internal disarmament. We're not carrying the grudge. And this is the important piece, is that somebody else's ill will does not create more ill will in us.
Yes, and I have said that somewhat, not as beautifully as that, but I've said that the compassion we continue to take, to experience, actually protects us.
Correct.
Yeah.
It does. And that's the value of metta practice. We are experiencing internal disarmament. That's what we are actively creating. It's 12:02, everybody. I didn't even realize that. Wow, we have to go. So I am so grateful for your attentiveness, for hanging in there with me today on all of this. And I'll be back in 2 weeks. Sylvia will be here next week. If you want to join us on Thursdays, please do. You can register on the Spirit Rock site. So much love to you all. May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering.